If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
Winter's Business Lunch. Elise Glink joins us now, owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. And of course, you hear her often on this. She fills in for me, and she's on this show all the time. And she's got This Week in Wealth on WGN Radio Sundays at 7 a.m. Basically, Elise, we go to you for anything when we need to talk to someone who knows what they're talking about.
Well, that's a very lovely thing to say, John, and delighted to be here today.
Yeah, and not so delighted about how Gen Xers are looking forward or maybe not at all, to retirement age. I know that we often have our retirement expectations a little out of whack. That's probably not unique to Gen X, but it still is striking.
Yeah, it's really striking. So I think you have to think about the generations, right? So we've got baby boomers, who the youngest of the baby boomers around 58, 59 this year. And then after that comes Gen Xs, and then comes millennials, right? And then comes Gen Z. I don't know why they're X, Y, and Z, right? Mm-hmm. Millennials are often known as Gen Y also. Mm-hmm. But the majority of Gen Xers who right now are, you know, in their 50s and 40s are very, very nervous. And they feel like that, you know, they're not going to be able to retire, or maybe only one third of them will be able to retire by age 65. Now, their full retirement age is 67. That's where it is today. But a huge portion aren't even sure that they're going to retire by age 75, and 11% don't think they're ever going to retire, which is kind of distressing.
Now, does this weed out who people who say, and we have a texter right now who says, by the way, Gen X rules, 847, I'm Gen X, I'll never retire, I like my lifestyle, I don't envy people that are retired. I guess what I'm saying is does it weed out people who say, I don't ever want to retire because I love my work? I assume the vast majority of these people want to retire at some point.
Well, I think that eventually people have to give it up. I think you should, if you don't want to retire, that's a different thing. I think that this is more about being able to call it, you know, a day, right? And be able to sort of step back and say, I just want to hang with my grandchildren if you have them, or I want to hang with my dog and my friends. I want to go travel the world. It's how much people are able to do it. And so one of the concerning things that came out in this study that Clever Real Estate did was just 20% of Gen Xers say they've never saved for retirement. 20%.
Not a dime.
Not a dime. Half of them say they don't have their finances under control. And a third of them say, 35% have say, that they have sacrificed saving for retirement in order to cover the basic necessities of life. So that isn't the, you know, the Gen Xer who's like, I love what I do, I want to keep doing it. That's more, I would retire if I could, but I don't have the cash.
Yeah. And this is, you know, these are people's own opinions taking stock of where they are in retirement. I wonder if we see spikes in these numbers, people concerned about how long they can live with their current, you know, financial situation or retired, if more people are uncertain during times of high inflation, like we've seen, right, where now every dollar we're looking at doesn't go as far, if that has maybe skewed people a little too far into the camp of, oh boy, I'm never going to be able to retire.
Well, I think it's a big concern. I mean, I should also point out that according to Fidelity, which runs, I don't know, several trillion dollars of retirement accounts, the typical Gen Xer has about $150,000 in their savings account, their retirement accounts, 401ks. That is not a whole lot of money these days.
No.
For retirement. And Fidelity, which recommends that you save at least, you know, $550,000, right?
Even that doesn't sound like enough going into retirement, right?
It doesn't. But not everyone lives in an expensive place like Chicago.
True,
or
true.
Certainly New York or San Francisco. But still, it is very expensive, and you have to wonder how, you know, people are thinking they're going to make ends meet. And so the way that many seniors are doing it today, so the generation that's sort of the older baby boomers and older than that, some of them have had to work part-time, either at, you know, you see Walmart greeters, for example, or they work as part-time assistants or teaching assistants, you know, just something to bring in a little bit of extra cash to supplement Social Security.
When I get to host Your Money Matters, and I know you'll be filling in for me next month for a week there, I like to, when we have a doom and gloom moment, I like to at least provide some ray of sunshine or some hope. What, at a certain age, you can start to do catch-up retirement amounts, right? Like, let's max those out. Let's really look at opportunities to start saving, even if you're late to the game. Starting or building up a little bit more now still will help.
Yeah, every dime you save today is a great thing, right? So never feel like it's too late. Even if you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, you can still set aside, you know, an amount for retirement and think about what that would actually mean. And there are lots of ways to do it, right? The catch-up provision, you can max out your 401k. If you've maxed out your 401k, usually companies today will offer a 401k. Roth 401k, which allows you to put away after-tax money right directly into a Roth. So there's lots of different ways that you can get around that, you know, not having saved. It's just a matter of finding it, the willpower today to maybe shift some of those things from the I must-haves today to I'd like to have them tomorrow.
Elise Glink, who's on Sunday mornings, 7 a.m. this week in Wealth. Elise, you know, we see now these stories about home prices falling and certainly falling by a lot in some markets where we saw the biggest jumps during 2020, 2021. How are we doing here in the Midwest?
We're doing okay. So home prices have declined in 30 of the 50 most populous U.S. metros, right? But the biggest drops were in places that saw these incredible price increases, right, over the last, you know, 4 years and during the pandemic. So Austin, Texas, I don't know how, it must have been up like 300%.
Oh, insane. At least that's what,
it was crazy.
That's what it felt like.
Right. And it's down 15%. Oakland is down 11.5%. Sacramento, San Francisco down a little over 9%. Seattle is down 9%. On the other side, over in Florida, where prices, despite hurricanes, continue to go skyward, Fort Lauderdale saw prices rise over 9% year over year. Cincinnati saw a 9% rise. Miami's 8.5%. West Palm Beach, 8%. And then, this was a bit of a surprise, Milwaukee. Prices there up 7.2%.
Hey.
Detroit is also starting to trend, I'm going to just say, which is kind of amazing. We haven't seen price growth like this in Detroit since right after the Great Recession, when I was writing stories and talking on the radio about how you could get a house for $600 or even get people to pay you to take a house.
Wow.
And in fact, one of those houses, John, this is kind of funny. There was a story the other day about one of those houses that was sold for, I don't know, $600 or $800. The people renovated it. It was a disaster inside. I mean, it was like,
right.
It was just disgusting. I mean, there was no other way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
They've renovated it, and that house today is worth something like $300,000 or $400,000.
So let's say they put 100 grand into it. Maybe that's even a stretch. Maybe 50, 60 grand. It's basically all profit at that point.
They've done really, really
yeah.
well. And what was great about that story is that they're kind of a nice young couple, millennials, who actually went to Detroit and bought this house, and everything is going very well there. But, you know, it's interesting to say, like, well, why is Detroit doing so well? It's just a little side point here. One of the reasons is that Quicken Loans, which is just a juggernaut in the space, the owner of Quicken Loans decided to make a $2 billion investment in downtown Detroit, bought up all these buildings that had gone into foreclosure, and over the years, the last 15 years, has been renovating it, renovating the downtown, leasing them out, and it's become like another fortune for him, but it has literally saved downtown Detroit.
I got to say, and Blackhawks fans who know where my loyalties lie, I've had a lot of fun going to see Blackhawks games in Detroit. It used to be like an annual trip we would do, and we literally watched it change, restaurants come back in. It just goes to show that rehabilitation can happen within these, especially these Rust Belt cities. You just need that money up front to do it, and the willpower of the community officials to do it too.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. And I want to talk about millennial home ownership for a minute because...
Please do.
Apartment List's 2023 Millennial Home Ownership Report came out. And so we talked a lot about Gen X not being able to retire. Millennials are struggling with home ownership, and they are so far behind other generations on the home ownership track. They started later in life because they were the first generation to really have this kind of extreme student loan debt.
Mm-hmm.
Then they got hit with the Great Recession. So mm-hmm. they were coming online and they couldn't find the right jobs. They were out of work for a while.
You're describing my life, Elise. This is giving me a little PTSD going through it, but please continue.
But here's what's so great. Look at how you ended up,
yeah.
Right? And you survived COVID-19, and now you're surviving inflation. But this generation has just been hit with a huge counterpunch of big, really milestone events in our history, back to back to back. And so as a result, John, their home ownership rate is only 51%, as opposed to all the other generations by the same age. We're all in the 60-70% range.
Right. And some people say, well, they're only at 51% now, whereas boomers are like 75%. But that's because it's now. No, like you just said, when you actually track it by age, they are behind the gap for practically every single year of life, age 30, 35, 40, they are far behind. Time will tell. And yeah, you know what? You mentioned the student loan debt. Some older millennials, it was still fairly affordable to go to college when I went, especially a state college like the University of Illinois. It was a little bit after me, more the middle and younger millennials. But that 08 recession, I mean, I jokingly said PTSD, but events like that do change. When you come out of college at 22, maybe you have a job for a year and then you lose it for two. That makes a huge difference for people.
Yeah, it really does. And it set a lot of people far behind because they also had this debt that they couldn't afford to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And they had credit card debt because they were trying to make expenses work and they were, running short of income. And what people fail to realize now that we're in kind of year three of this extraordinary job market, I mean, we're at like the lowest levels in history of unemployment. But back after the Great Recession, and even if you look back, 2000, 2001, that recession, what you saw is a very, very slow job market. It took a long time for it to ignite. And we didn't start to have a great job market until around 2016, 2017, yeah. 2018 in this country. And then, that's a lot of years for people to come out of college, really searching for a job, having to take stuff that's not really in their wheelhouse, that they didn't study or go to college for. It's really been quite a ride. And at the same time, you've got college tuition that's been soaring at a rate of something like 10-11% per year in a lot of cases. Even at state schools today, University of Illinois, where I went also, by the way, John, didn't
know
you were a fellow
of mine. Oh, there we go. Yeah, ILL.
But even today, if you're trying to go to the University of Illinois and you want to be in the engineering school, it's something like $40,000 a year.
Yeah. And even in state, like it's insane, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, you get a discount, but it's not as much as it used to be. Got about a minute left, Elise. Someone pointed out on the text line, I think it's a good point to make, though, in regards to millennials. Are they about to be the inheritor of the biggest wealth transfer in country's history, though? Right?
Oh, so happy you asked this question. I do need more than a minute, but I'm just going to limit my remarks to this. Everybody thinks that there's this massive wealth transfer that's going on and about to go on. And in some cases, it's true. But you have people living longer in this country than ever. I know so many people who are 100, 109, 98. They're going to use up a lot of that money. So I think, some people sure are going to die young and that money's going to transfer. But people who are healthy and wealthier tend to live longer anyway. And so I think that we might not see quite as much wealth transfer as everybody's been expecting, but time will tell.
Right, and you're also bringing up a great point that as healthcare costs continue to go up, not a lot of people have long-term care insurance.
Yep.
That wealth that people think is there, that nest egg maybe that they're relying on, God willing, parents live for a lot longer, or that could be a lot more depleted than people realize. Yeah, we do need more than a minute to talk about that. We'll do it another time, Elise, and we'll listen on Sunday, okay?
Sounds like a plan, John. Thanks.
Elise Klink, always great to chat with her. Elise Klink, This Week in Wealth, Sundays at 7 a.m. All right, we roll on in now with Jim Dahlke, one of our frequent guests here on Mondays especially, from Chicago Inno. Jim, good to talk to you, my friend.
Hey, John, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
As always. Okay. We're going to talk about how venture funding has been tough compared to previous eras. Can you first just, in layman's terms, like I'm 10 years old, what is venture capital? What does that mean?
Yeah, so venture capital is really the primary means for startups to raise funding, often before they've got a lot of their own revenues.
And who do they fundraise from?
Yeah, so they fundraise from limited partners. So, often, family offices, universities, rich families, et cetera, are the folks that really back these venture capital funds. And so, you know, venture capital is kind of really, you know, the lifeblood for the startup ecosystem. This is really, you know, what companies need to kind of, you know, hire and gain traction and really kind of get their companies off the ground before they kind of turn into the big economic engines once they're, you know, sort of more mature.
Okay, so having said that, tapping from universities, these are wealthy people who want to invest and get a return on their investment from these, you know, startups, that's gone down is what you're saying, and gone down precipitously in the past couple of years.
That's right. So, you know, took a look at the recent data, the quarterly data that just came out, and really kind of took a specific focus on the number of venture capital deals that are taking place. And really, we're seeing a pretty big decline. So the deal count, last quarter was 20% behind where it was from the quarter before and 45% year over year. We took a sort of specific look into cities. So, you know, what we're seeing is a lot of cities across the country, including Chicago, are really sort of vying to be these sort of next emerging tech hubs. And some of the biggest tech hubs that we've seen really are seeing their deal counts plummet. So in Austin, for example, the number of venture capital deals was down 60% from a year ago. In Miami, it was down 51% from a year ago. In Seattle, down 56% from a year ago. In Chicago, deal counts falling also, but not quite as severe, just 32% from a year ago. So Chicago perhaps faring a little bit better than some of its counterparts.
Can you explain why the average listener should care that a tech company isn't getting the funding that they need and that it's gone down? I just imagine a lot of people listening being like, oh, poor tech, poor emerging companies. But it's broader than that. It impacts the whole economy, doesn't it?
It does. And really, you know, a lot of these tech companies historically have been, you know, the growth engines for lots of cities. So, you know, the tech companies are these are the companies that are going to be hiring very, very quickly, typically what we've seen over the last several years. You know, these are the companies where lots of, you know, new grads want to work for. People like to work for tech companies. And so, you know, it's really kind of important for new cities, for cities to have these tech startups because it's a place where new grads want to go and they want to stay locally. And so having a vibrant, thriving tech community is important for, you know, every local economy and is certainly a very, very big piece of most cities' job engines. And so, you know, you want to have, you know, a very healthy, you know, funding environment for startups because that means, you know, there's more jobs in town, you know, more, you know, young grads sticking around and, you know, can continue to help the local economy.
Right. And I love when anyone would text that in from their iPhone, because that's how we get things like that, is from new tech companies trying new things, including one out of here in Chicago. Tell us a little bit about Event Noir.
Yeah, Event Noir, interesting, you know, a new startup in town. So this is a company that's created a ticketing platform, kind of similar to, you know, a SeatGeek or an Eventbrite or a Ticketmaster, but they have an interesting approach. They're really geared towards the Black community. So really, you know, all about supporting Black culture and kind of creating a ticketing system, you know, specifically for finding and discovering, you know, events in the Black community. And so they just raised $1 million. They've backed by a handful of notable folks. The Google Black Entrepreneurs Fund invested in them. The Mountain Dew Real Change Opportunity Fund invested in Event Noir as well. So, you know, what I think is really interesting too is Event Noir, part of their business model is actually kicking some of their ticketing fees back to the event host. So, of course, we've seen all kinds of headlines recently from Taylor Swift to Beyonce and all sort of Ticketmaster drama around, you know, skyrocketing ticket fees and, you know, making it so hard for folks to get into, you know, these events and these concerts. And, you know, really what Event Noir is trying to do is say, like, hey, like, you know, we're doing ticketing fees too, but, you know, we're going to kick some of those fees to the creators of these events, kind of reinvesting in the community. So, yeah, Event Noir, really cool new startup in Chicago.
Yeah, and for people that might say, well, I mean, Ticketmaster and Eventbrite, they got to cover things towards Black culture. I imagine these people would say, no, not always.
Right. And, you know, I think that they really want to be a community partner. I think with so many event, you know, hosts, the relationship, you know, between event organizer and your ticketing service can kind of be not exactly a friendly relationship, right? You're always sort of frustrated at how much it costs and maybe the experience isn't great for your end user. And so that creates a frustrating experience as well. So I think there is ample opportunity for disruption in the ticketing space. And it will be interesting to see kind of how these niche marketplaces pop up.
If you live in the Chicagoland area and the thought of drone deliveries scares you, you might be in for some bad luck. Apparently, we're a great place for developing this technology, Jim.
Yeah, you know, a group got together at 1871, the Innovation Hub here in Chicago, really kind of to talk about this specifically just a couple of weeks ago. And really kind of the focus was how Chicago really is an ideal sort of testing ground for drones for a few different reasons. One, you know, the sort of obvious one, the Chicago being just a logistics hub in general, a great place for, you know, logistics, tech, and innovation. So drones can kind of be a logical next step of testing here. The weather also, even though the weather is kind of crummy, a great place to test, right? If you can fly a drone in a 60-mile-an-hour windstorm and a blizzard, you can probably fly a drone pretty much anywhere. And, you know, one reason why Chicago is an interesting place for drone deliveries, actually because it's home to a startup here called Valkyrie, and they are a smart drone mailbox. So I think it's a really interesting piece of the drone conversation is that, hey, drones are great, but what do you do when they drop off the stuff? It's a little simpler in a suburban environment and in a rural environment, but, you know, when you've got a condo to drop off at, or, you know, an apartment building, a locked mailbox, your mailroom door, where do you put these drone deliveries? And so this company is creating essentially a smart drone mailbox to securely receive drone deliveries. So lots of things to think about here with drone delivery, but Chicago could be a really great place to test out the tech.
I used to live in a neighborhood in Chicago in a condo that was adjacent to the Brown Line and then power lines on the other side, and my porch was about 2 feet by 4 feet. I'd love to see a drone try and deliver something to me then, but hey, we'll give it our best shot. Jim, it's always good to talk to you, my friend.
Thank you, John.
ChicagoNO.com, where you can read more about those stories. All right, let's get the Wintrust Business Minute with Vince Vaughn.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago-based cable news channel News Nation is launching 24-hour news programming Monday through Friday, starting today, with the addition of a new 4-hour-long midday block called News Nation Now and the debut of The Hill, a political news and analysis program starting at 4 p.m. from Washington. News Nation is owned by Nexstar, the parent company of WGN Radio. State Farm is raising its Illinois car insurance rates for a second time this year. Come June, customers will see the rates increase by 6%. It follows a 6.5% increase earlier this year. State Farm says most six-month policies will see prices go up $114. The company blames it on inflation. Northbrook-based Impossible Objects will unveil its new CBAM 25 machine at the Rapid Plus TCT trade show in Chicago. The 3D printing machine is said to print 15 times faster than the competition while using advanced materials. It'll be commercially available next year. I'm Vic Vaughn, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
All right, the business of food. Here's Steve Alexander.
I have two words for you: free money. After I tell you we're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, free money. If you're in the restaurant business.
Restaurants, taverns, bars, caterers, brewers, wineries, and food trucks.
Sam Toya, president and CEO of the Illinois Restaurant Association, says the state has $50 million to hand out.
And the grant amounts range from $5,000 to $50,000.
And you can get some of that if yours is a small operation.
These businesses have to have 50 or fewer employees, and we're open. Here's a big one. And they have to be open before March 12th of 2020. And did not get more than $10,000 in federal or local relief money. But if you got PPP, you're okay.
Say that again.
If your business did receive PPP, they are still eligible. But if you received the IRF, Restaurant Revitalization Fund, you're not eligible. Many restaurants did not get any or enough federal relief. And this is one way we're working to help the hospitality industry recover from the last few years.
Okay, the deadline to apply is coming soon.
May 10th.
All the nitty-gritty is online.
IllinoisRestaurants.org, and you can see it on our website. We have everything you need to know.
Sam Toya says even in good times, the restaurant business is tough. And how are things now?
Labor shortage is still an issue for quite a few restaurants. It's getting better. but it's still a little bit of an issue. And the biggest issue right now is obviously inflation.
And he says you and I can do our parts.
We encourage everyone to visit their local independent restaurants, because restaurants are the soul of every neighborhood here throughout the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois.
By the way, beyond the $50 million for restaurants, there is another $75 million for hotels and $50 million more for the performing arts. All of the information is online.
Like I said, Illinois restaurants.
Thank you, Sam Toya.
Talk to you later.
From the farm to your belly, today's National Pigs in a Blanket Day. I'm Steve Alexander, and that's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Yeah, the transfer of wealth obviously comes usually at a sad point of life, and it's something to get through, and it's difficult, and taxes make it a little less fun. Here navigating a couple questions around that is Stephanie Feldman from Mesereau. How are you doing, Stephanie?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for joining us on Your Money Matters on Mondays. It's always a Mesereau Monday. So glad you're able to come here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Okay. If property is transferred from one generation to the next, a common question I get from people, and I don't have the answers, is do I have to pay, and let's say we sell the property, right? Like you're selling your parents' place. Do you pay taxes on the difference from when your parents bought the house and all the years of gains they have? Do you pay the capital gains tax on that? Or is it only from the day you guys inherited it legally? That's what you pay the taxes on. Can you help us navigate that a little bit?
Yeah, of course. Actually, the capital gains tax would be based on something called a stepped up value. So if assets are includable in someone's estate, the basis, if you will, is not what the parents may have paid for the home, but rather the valuation, or if it's a home, the appraisal value that someone assessed as of the date of death. So that difference between the market value at the time of sale versus the appraisal at the date of death value helps really mitigate the capital gains tax that would potentially be assessed at the time of sale.
I've heard of some people that say, well, you know, my mother is aging a little bit, and before she gets to a point where maybe dementia creeps in or just old age kind of creeps in, she wants to add me to the name, my name to the house, like as a co-owner. Does that impact things then when it comes to after passing in the taxes? Like, would you start accruing that capital gains or that basis when you put your name on the house?
Yeah, because it's essentially when that's a transference of property. So at the time when, you know, mom puts son or daughter on the title, you're essentially gifting part of the house to them. And then the results would be only getting half of a step up in the basis. So sometimes individuals do that because they don't want the assets to go through probate, or they want their child to have helpful control when someone isn't able to pay bills or do things as they used to. And a way to get around that, or a more appropriate way to do that, would be to coordinate with the individual's estate planning attorney and make sure the home is titled appropriately, either in their revocable trust, or you could do a transfer on death. And also they should have proper powers of attorney in place so that, you know, son, daughter, or whomever they have entrusted to do things for them in the event of incapacity could step in at that time, rather than just gifting the asset. And if that's not the intent.
So think ahead of the game and get that power of attorney and all that set up. And then you get all the benefits of adding someone's name to the property without the negative tax consequences.
It'll still allow them to, you know, pay bills on the person's behalf, or make sure things are taken care of, without having to gift them ownership of the property.
When it comes to stocks, you and I talked about this, I think last week or the week before, similar sort of thing, right? You want to just transfer the stock from one generation to the next because the basis steps up to the value of the stock when you get it, the day that you get it. You're not going to pay when you sell it the capital gains that it accrued during your mother or father's or whoever you're inheriting it from, their lifetime, correct?
Exactly. The same exact thing. Any property that's inherited at the time of someone's passing, that valuation or basis, if you will, gets stepped up to that date of death value.
Okay.
So sometimes you can gift during life, but just keep in mind that the donor's basis gets carried over to the person you're gifting to if you do it during life rather than getting the step up.
This is one of the most confusing things ever. Not what you just said, what I'm about to say. The gift tax. People are always so confused about how much you can give another family member. We only got about a minute and a half for this answer, but can you give it to us in simple terms when gift tax gets enacted?
Right. So in any year, and this changes annually based on cost of living adjustments, but the annual exclusion amount, the amount you can give to an individual without any gift tax, is $17,000 per individual or $34,000 for a married couple. You can also pay direct education expenses or medical expenses for anyone, and that does not count as a gift because it's what we consider a qualified expense for those things, but it does have to be a direct payment to the institution.
So don't you have like a lifetime amount, though, that you're allowed before you start getting taxed, or are you saying?
Yeah, so in addition to that, but that would require a gift tax return, but there's not a state tax or a gift tax assessed to it at that time. During your life, any one individual can gift up to $12.92 million for their lifetime. That's due to sunset in 2025, at which point, if nothing is done, it will revert back to the $5 million. But with inflation, it's really 6.8. So for now, the lifetime exemption is $12.92 million per individual.
But over that certain amount in a year, you have to report it, but you're not taxed on it until you get above your lifetime amount.
Exactly. So, you know, as people get older or depending on their circumstances, there's advantages to utilizing some of that exemption amount now to get the appreciation out of your estate as well. So it really depends on your balance sheet, your cash flow needs, and, you know, many circumstances and variables to that individual and family.
Stephanie Feldman, just one of the many smart people I get to chat with at Mesirow all the time. 1-877-MESIROW, MESIROW, or Mesirow.com. Stephanie, thanks for your time.
Thank you.